The Dragonfly podcast series deals with mature and sensitive topics that may be triggering for some listeners. If you or someone you care about is struggling with addiction or depression, please know that you are not alone and that help is available. We encourage you to reach out to your local crisis center or a trusted family member or friend for support. They say you die twice, once when you stop breathing, and again when someone says your name for the last time. On Saturday, July 31st, 1993, the news of Brett Kantor's murder spread like wildfire across the Hollywood music scene. Everybody that knew him or loved him was shook. They couldn't help but wonder who had killed Brett and why. Some believed he had been stabbed by a jealous lover. Others were convinced Brett's murder was an organized hit, and even a few thought it might be some weird, satanic killing. That morning, Cliff had made a frantic phone call to his parents. It's one conversation Ronnie Kantor says she will never forget. Her beautiful son Brett was dead, and even worse, he was murdered. Shocked and saddened by the devastating loss, her husband Paul called his youngest son Mark to deliver the bad news.
Well, on that sad day, my father called me and told me Brett was murdered. And it was a very big shock to me.
Later that same day, Paul Kantor received a phone call from Detective Aldo at the Hollywood Homicide Unit, and he asked the family to meet him at the police station. Detective Aldo wanted to talk with them to learn more about Brett's personal life and what they knew about his final days leading up to his murder. However, Mark found some of Detective Aldo's questions bizarre and was concerned the police were buying into some crazy theory one of Brett's friends had told them.
I had to go over to the Hollywood Police Department where they were doing the investigation, and he asked me what I knew about the murder, and I told him how I went to the clubs in the after hours, and he was asking me about other people because everyone had their own opinion. So the detectives at the time were very, very confused from interviewing all of Brett's friends. Everyone had a different story to what could have happened.
Brett had lived in a small one-bedroom apartment in West Hollywood on Vista Avenue, and it was a few blocks from Dolph Lundgren's nightclub, Black and Blue. After Cliff discovered Brett's body that morning, he called the police. They quickly arrived and roped off his four-story apartment complex off Hollywood Boulevard. The officer who was first on the scene took preliminary statements from witnesses. Next, he asked if Brett's neighbors had heard or seen anything suspicious the night he was killed. Tom Dre reads the police report that describes Brett's crime scene.
Cliff Kantor, on July 31st, 1993, at approximately 2:30 a.m., went to the victim's apartment. He knocked on the door, received no reply, and made entry through the sliding glass door located off the living room. He found the deceased on the floor, covered with a blanket and pillow over his head. Los Angeles Fire Department Engine 41 was contacted at 2:31 a.m. and immediately responded to the scene. Upon arrival, observing the victim had no signs of life, they pronounced Brett Kantor dead at 2:37 a.m. The victim's bedroom consisted of a queen bed, a dresser, two nightstands, lamps, and a closet with sliding mirror doors. No signs of struggle were apparent in the apartment. No weapon was found.
Detective Lamkin of the Hollywood Homicide Unit arrived later that morning. He wanted to evaluate the complexity and scope of Brett's murder scene and plan the next steps in the investigation. A few hours later, the police went door to door to locate and identify witnesses. Also, they wanted to eliminate any possible suspects. The tenants included actors, musicians, restaurant workers, and college students. The police report continues.
Neighbors stated on July 30th at approximately 3:30 a.m., loud noises and yelling were heard within Brett Cantor's apartment. The yelling and noise stopped shortly after, and the neighbors assumed all the commotion was over, so the police were not contacted.
There were 54 apartments in Brett's building, and the complex had a security system that required an access code. Brett lived on the first floor, just above the main lobby on the left side of the building. His killers would have had to walk down a long, well-lit hallway past several neighbors' doors before reaching his corner apartment, number 111. To the left of apartment 111 was a lone black door at the end of the hallway that opened to a small stairwell and two more black doors. The door on the right led to an underground garage. The door on the left opened to the pool area and an alleyway exit. It would have been an easy escape route for someone with sinister motives. When the Hollywood Homicide Unit discovered who Brett Cantor was, they flagged it as a high-profile murder. His case was immediately transferred to LA's Elite Robbery Homicide Division, and they asked Detective Rick Jackson to lead the investigation.
My name is Rick Jackson. I am a retired detective from the Los Angeles Police Department. I worked various homicide units for the last 28 years of my career. I retired in 2013. In early August of 1993, I was assigned to the Major Crime Investigation Section of Robbery Homicide Division. We were stationed out of the headquarters at Parker Center in downtown Los Angeles. I became the lead detective on the murder of Brett Cantor. The Hollywood Homicide Unit had handled the original call out on the murder investigation. They handled the crime scene, and after 2 days, opted to ask Robbery Homicide Division to assume investigative responsibility for the case. And as I said, I was the lead detective that was put on Brett Cantor's case.
On August 3rd, 1993, Detective Jackson returned to Brett's apartment. He was joined by homicide detectives Aldo and Dunn to review the crime scene and gather more information.
Well, as I mentioned, I was not the lead detective on the day that the body was discovered, which was July 31st. It was early in the morning. Brett's body was discovered in his apartment by his brother, Cliff Cantor. He notified the police. The Hollywood Homicide Unit went to the location and did the crime scene investigation. When I was assigned the investigation on August 2nd, I returned to the apartment building and viewed the crime scene with the original detectives. And based on their information and information I also developed through the investigation that I conducted, Brett was probably killed between 2 a.m. and 4:30 a.m. It was a Thursday night into Friday morning. That was on July 30th, 1993. Unfortunately, about 3:30 in the morning to 4:30 in the morning, some neighbors in one of the apartments in close proximity to Brett's heard a male voice screaming, "Help, don't kill me." They were aware, they heard exactly what was said, and then the voice was not heard anymore, so they did not call the police, which was unfortunate. It took another day for the body to be discovered once Brett had not made contact with any of the regular people that he talked to. And that's when Cliff came over and was able to get into the apartment building. It's apparently the suspect or suspects were allowed entry by Brett. He was found in his bedroom on the floor. The cause of death was a combination of manual strangulation and multiple stab wounds. He was also kicked, maybe stomped. There was no indication of really a struggle that was put up by Brett. So it appears that there were likely multiple suspects involved, and he was obviously restrained because a fight would have been involved if it would have been a one-on-one situation. There was no major ransacking found in the apartment. Robbery doesn't seem to be the obvious motive. His wallet was gone, which basically mostly had credit cards in it. There was some significant amounts of cash found in some drawers that could have easily been found if somebody would have wanted to open some drawers. So unfortunately, there were a lot of motives that we would eventually establish as possibilities for why Brett's life was taken. And we can get into those as we go through this interview.
The killers left behind an expensive Rolex watch and $5,000 in cash. The watch had been lying on the dresser, and the money had been stashed in a drawer. The only personal items missing from the murder scene were his wallet and possibly a small handgun that Brett had kept for protection, since he had to carry large amounts of cash after club events.
We explored all kinds of the club scene possibilities. You know, it was a learning experience for me of what was going on with the club scenes and how it all worked and how the monetary splits were done for a particular night that a promoter promoted. I learned quite a bit about that. And so we looked at it as a possibility, but most of it never really went anywhere. Not to say that that couldn't have been part of it. There were multiple co-owners of the Dragonfly. There was one majority owner, and then there were several minority owners. Brett was eventually given 10% because the nights he worked at Dragonfly and promoted, those were the most successful nights that Dragonfly had, were his promotion nights. And so that was part of the reason why he was offered a part ownership. But we did talk to people, I think all the owners, and I think there were four other owners other than Brett. We talked to other promoters, some that were friends of Brett that started trying to vie for some of the same nights that Brett promoted somewhere else. But those seemed to be worked out between the parties, and it never really involved any kind of major dispute that we determined. We looked at all of that, but nothing jumped out at us as far as this looks like the way to go. There were a lot of rumors in this case, and part of it was involved the club scene. I mean, he was a well-known guy in the club scene. And so when something like this happens, it's a major event, and everybody's talking about it, and everybody's speculating, and rumors and innuendos and gossip get thrown out there. And as it moves away, it sometimes gets to be believed to be the actual likely scenario of what really happened. And so we were inundated with that kind of information, and we'd explore it to the extent we could, but it never really led anywhere. It was a really frustrating case, to be honest, because it was a pretty brutal case. I was really invested in it because, you know, I knew Cliff and I got to know his folks, Brett's folks, and they were obviously traumatized by it, as were his coworkers at Chrysalis Records. He was really highly respected there, according to everybody we talked to.
Apartment 111 had been Brett's first bachelor pad, and he valued his privacy. Some would even call him secretive. Only a few of his family and friends were ever invited over to his place. Mostly he used his apartment to entertain women he was dating or hang out with a few close friends. At the time of his murder, his latest romantic interest had been actress Rose McGowan.
Again, this seemed to be very personal. It seemed like at least one of the people there probably knew Brett to some degree. As I indicated earlier, it looks like he allowed entry to at least one person. Who knows if the others came along afterwards or they all came together and Brett knew one of them. He didn't entertain at that apartment a lot other than with his female companions that he had over. He didn't party there. He didn't set up business meetings there. Not that many people were in and out of his apartment, based on numerous interviews I did.
Brett was sober, and he had been for years. But working in Hollywood's nightclub scene meant he was constantly surrounded by users, dealers, and the criminals behind its drug market. For that reason, Detective Jackson did his due diligence, investigating to see whether Brett's murder had been drug-related.
We learned that Brett had a substance abuse problem when he was a teenager, but he had been sober and, by everybody's account, was religiously involved in AA and sponsoring others from AA, attending meetings on a regular basis. His autopsy revealed no alcohol, no drugs in his system. There was nothing in the apartment, and we went through it in very, very great detail. I mean, we searched everywhere because we were looking for money that he often kept, supposedly, because he did a cash business. So we were there with his brother, Cliff, who monitored us, which we requested in case any large sums were found. There was no indication of drugs. Not one person that we talked to indicated they suspected that. There were rumors, again, we get back to the rumor mill, out there that it might have been some kind of a drug deal and some specifics were given, but nothing ever panned out on any of that. I mean, everybody has secrets, I guess, to some degree, so who knows, but there was nothing that we came up with that even supported anything to do with drugs or a drug deal.
Detective Jackson met with Dragonfly's business partners. He needed to find out what Brett's partners knew. David Shockett, one of Dragonfly's co-owners, recalls the moment he first learned of Brett's murder.
Somebody said he missed a meeting at work. None of that kind of added up until I'd just gotten back. I was dating this girl named Maria. We had just gotten back from breakfast. I had a message. I think it was on my answer machine or a voicemail. Hey, David, this is Steve Edelson, your partner. It's like, yeah, fuck it. I know who you are, dude. It's like, Steve is a very, very good operator of bars and nightclubs. Like, he knows how to run them really well as anybody I've been in business with. And he was also very much a stickler. And so I'm thinking, why is he calling me? What is one of the banks $5 off or something like that? He goes, I'm calling to tell you our partner, Brett Kanner. And then he said, was murdered last night. And like the second the word murdered came out of his mouth, like, you realize to me, he's still alive. So it's as if he's being murdered in that moment. And it was like, I kind of screamed out because I was like in shock because everything came back. He wasn't at the club last night. He missed a meeting at work the day before. Like all those little tiny facts coagulated in that one moment. It was just like, I was speechless. And like, I started to cry. It's like I couldn't believe this was true. It was a devastating moment. It really was. It's not a moment you want on your answering machine for sure. But obviously made sense with all the other little ancillary factors that I had heard previous to that. But yeah, that was not great.
David Shockett remembers it as being a scary time for the business partners of Dragonfly and other music promoters. They all thought that maybe one of them could be next.
It hasn't actually occurred to me until this moment you just asked me. But that was a scary time, you know, because nobody knew why he was murdered. Was it something Dragonfly related? Was somebody angry at the club for something? I absolutely, when I would come into the apartment, I would open the door and look around before I stepped in. I had a closet in my apartment that I opened carefully for a few weeks because nobody knew what the actual reason. I guess they still don't. You know, that's why we're here.
During Brett's initial murder investigation, a dark cloud hung over the Hollywood music scene. As many struggled to cope with the loss of their dear friend, Mother Tongue guitarist Brian remembers how devastated everyone was.
I remember my then girlfriend was friends with him. Somehow she found out. I feel like it was like a phone call. I remember I was being home and she was very distraught. That music scene was so small and tight that everyone knew. You know, you go to a show, you basically see the same people all the time. And he was a fixture at pretty much every show. I lived directly across the street from him, so I'd see him often. So it was like, wow, you know, it was definitely very shocking. I just remember going get breakfast, and then that was like a whole other scene, or get lunch, and it was, or get coffee, and everyone was talking about it, and it definitely affected a lot of people.
On August 2nd, 1993, Brett's former girlfriend, Toni, wrote the following post in her diary.
Why would anyone want to hurt Brett? Cliff found him, I think, Friday night. dead, stabbed in his apartment. Todd told me the news, but I wasn't sure. It wasn't just a rumor. I was working the discipline show at Gaslight, and Alyssa, my old roommate, bopped up. Just matter-of-factly darted out the news, confirming it was true. And I tried not to cry, but I didn't succeed, so I left. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of people in this world that have it coming that do deserve it, and I have no problem saying that. But Jesus Christ, not Brett. He is a good guy.
Pat Tapia was intrigued by the conversation we had with both Dragonfly's business partners, Steve Edelson and David Schockett. Also the information Detective Jackson provided about Brett's cold case. Pat knew we would have to investigate further to find out what really happened that night, and he reached out to the LA County's coroner's office, where Brett's autopsy report had been collecting dust since 1993. Pat's first request for a copy of the report was denied. The coroner's office said it was because Brett's murder was a high-profile case. Brett's brother Mark then reached out, making a family request for the report. The coroner's office relented. Finally, we would have a real shot at piecing together the mystery of Brett's unsolved murder. On July 30th, we received a copy of the coroner's report on the 27th anniversary of Brett's murder. It felt like fate. We took it as a sign that Brett was helping us from the other side, and that he hoped we would bring his killers out of the shadows and into the light. This was the first time anyone outside the original homicide detective team assigned to Brett's murder case had reviewed the report. We knew from our investigation that the last person to see Brett alive was his coworker and close friend, Doug. The two were out on the evening of July 30th at a Beverly Hills nightclub, where Brett had gotten into an argument with another promoter over a competing club called Velveeta. The confrontation upset Brett, so he left the club early with Doug and dropped him off at his house before heading back to his West Hollywood apartment. He told Doug he had plans to meet up with a girl later that night and arrived home at 2 a.m. Brett received a phone call at 2:30 a.m., and less than 2 hours later, he was dead. The coroner's report revealed information about how Brett was murdered and provided important clues on who might be responsible. It was clear that the rumors circulating on the internet about Brett's cause of death were false. The coroner's report stated that Brett had been beaten, stabbed, and strangled. There were two knives used, and based on his injuries, it was believed there were multiple people involved. After reviewing the report, criminal profiler Paul Delhauer outlined four important clues for the team that he thought could help identify the killers. Tom Dre explains.
The first clue. Brett was found lying on his side, wearing a white t-shirt and boxer shorts. He was facing the mirror in his bedroom closet. The killers had put a pillow over his head and a blanket over his body. Delhauer says that when killers cover a victim's body with a blanket, they're burying them symbolically. But the fact that they laid a pillow over Brett's head suggested they had some kind of remorse for what they have done. They perhaps even had an emotional attachment to him. Based on these assumptions, we infer that Brett knew at least one of his killers, and that one of them, most likely, was female. The second clue, Brett's apartment showed no signs of forced entry. Nothing of significant value was stolen from his apartment. That day, Brett had told Doug that he was meeting up with a girl, but he didn't mention her name. Had his hookup turned deadly? Did he forget to lock his door? Or had the killers been lying in wait? The third clue, based on the evidence, homicide detectives believed the assailants had quickly subdued Brett. He may have been held at gunpoint and forced to kneel or lie down on the floor. Photos from the crime scene indicate that his murder was incredibly brutal. The fourth clue. Brett had been found grasping a single strand of light blonde hair. Did it belong to the woman he was supposed to meet later that night? If so, where was she? Had she met a similar fate to Brett's? Or was it all a setup?
Pat Tapia spent 38 years working in law enforcement And for a period of time, he worked as a supervisor at the LA County Jail. Back then, he was responsible for over 5,000 inmates, many of them violent criminals. When Tapia reviewed the coroner's report, something clicked. He recognized this type of killing. He'd seen it before in the LA County Jail he'd worked at. It was what they called a blitz.
My first thought after I reviewed the coroner's report was that it looked like an organized hit by somebody who had served time in a prison or a correctional facility. I spoke with one of my retired homicide detective colleagues to get a second opinion on Brett's cold case. When I provided more details about his murder, my colleague's initial thoughts were that the killing was most likely personal, provoked by a jealous lover or an ex-boyfriend of a lover or something to that effect. However, when I described Brett's injuries listed in the coroner's report, which included blunt force trauma to the head and the fact he was stabbed multiple times, he changed his mind. We both agreed that this was most likely a surprise attack, commonly referred to as a blitz, orchestrated by multiple people with gang or organized crime ties. I knew we would have to dive deeper into Brett's case to determine if someone had ordered his killing and why, so I was immediately intrigued when two anonymous club promoters who worked with Brett in 1993 mentioned three other club-related murders right around the same time he was killed. The promoters said one club was called Impact on La Cienega Boulevard, and another club was named Odyssey. They were both notorious for criminal activity in 1993, and I'm currently reviewing police reports to see if there might be any similarities between the murders.
When Tom Sturgis, the CEO of Chrysalis Music, learned of Brett's tragic death, he was heartbroken, along with Brett's co-workers at the label. Chrysalis Music immediately set up a $20,000 reward, asking the public for information about Brett's murder, and posted hundreds of flyers around Hollywood. Surely, they thought, someone must know something. 4 days after Brett's murder, Variety magazine posted the following obituary. Chrysalis Music Group A&R executive Brett Cantor was found slain in his Hollywood home on July 31st. Cantor was also a partner in Hollywood's nightclub Dragonfly and was a well-known music promoter of underground parties known as raves. He died of multiple stab wounds. No motive has been established for the murder, but the investigation has been moved to downtown LAPD headquarters. Cantor was last seen leaving Club 435 North in Beverly Hills in the early hours of Friday morning. Brett Cantor is survived by his parents, Paul and Rhonda Cantor, his grandmother, and his two brothers, Cliff and Mark. The funeral service is scheduled for Wednesday, August 4th at 11 a.m. at the Mount Sinai Memorial Park in Burbank, California. Brett's parents prepared themselves to face their worst nightmare, burying their son. His funeral was a traditional Jewish memorial service. Such memorials are grounded in the principle of honoring the dead. Those who had known Brett in life believed he deserved honor in death. The turnout at his funeral was evidence enough. More than 500 people attended Brett's funeral, and it was standing room only. The mourners ranged from Brett's family and friends to young Hollywood personalities, rock stars, club owners, promoters, and music industry professionals. For all its traditional simplicity, Brett's funeral felt like a rock concert. There were so many people there that not everyone could fit into the chapel. Brett's family had to set up loudspeakers outside so that everyone else could listen to the service. The mourners included several women who claimed they had been Brett's girlfriend. Even in death, Brett was a ladies' man, says Dragonfly owner David Shockett.
I remember we had a wake at Dragonfly, and there was three different little pockets of people where I saw a girl crying and people consoling her. I'm like, who's that? And they're like, oh, that's Brett's girlfriend. I'm like, oh, okay. And I walk over and I'm like, who's that? Oh, that's Brett's girlfriend. I was like, fuck, man. And there was like three girlfriends and they're all sobbing concurrently in different little areas of the club.
Several musicians owed their success to Brett. He had given them a leg up in the industry through his job at Chrysalis Music. Many of the artists came out to mourn him. Alternative rock band Mother Tongue was one of them. This is Devo.
I remember going to the funeral, expressing my condolences to his dad, and just the anguish in his dad and the whole family. We were friends with Cliff. I mean, just, man, that feeling is hard to describe, but anyone that's has had an experience with Brett's death or someone else that has died suddenly or, you know, from violence, you know what I'm talking about.
When Brett's best friend, Amy, looks back at his funeral, she remembers thinking how the memorial service reminded her of the music video for Guns N' Roses' hit track, November Rain. It felt like all of Hollywood had come out to mourn him, but she also remembers feeling scared. She had the chilling feeling that one of Brett's killers was at his funeral, watching her. This is Amy.
Well, I remember that we were all kind of joking that the cultural reference was that it was like the music video for Guns N' Roses, but it just was like this very large, every character from Hollywood, West Side, everywhere, rock and roll, hip hop, music industry, starlets, up and coming young Hollywood. I mean, it was just this hodgepodge of all the people that were in the scene, and they were at the funeral, and I remember this one song that they played. It was by a band called Brad. The song was called Shame. The lyrics were like, you'll never know just how dark this way can be. I searched for that song before there was a streaming and all this stuff, because I lost it. I think I had it on a mixtape and I lost it. And I think I asked his brother what it was and he told me. But I remember that song playing. And I also remember feeling really scared because I felt like the person who did it was there. And I felt whoever was involved was around us. And so for those months after, I remember driving and being at a stoplight and thinking it could be the person next to me. I just remember feeling like I didn't trust anyone except our small core group, like his brothers and Doug and my other friends that were, we were teenagers together and into our 20s. I definitely was very suspicious and didn't feel safe. And I also remember feeling special too, because we were that close. And I do remember people treating me with total kindness.
The idea that one of his killers may have attended the funeral occurred to Detective Jackson, too. He reviewed the funeral's guest list. Would the killers have been bold enough to attend Brett's service? We would later learn in an interview with Steve Edelson, the main partner at Dragonfly, that Brett's death had triggered a mysterious event at the club. One of Dragonfly's doormen abruptly quit his job and left the country after Brett was murdered. However, Edelson didn't believe Brett's murder had any connection to Dragonfly. But a lot of people thought it might and were concerned over the club's business decision to kick some people out of Friday Night Riot. This is Steve.
Anybody who was not allowed in the club, that reflected on me, not on Brett. We had many partners and promoters, so you can imagine when the club was open, there's thousands of people waiting out in line, and there's, you know, a door staff and velvet ropes, and then I would come out there once in a while to oversee, to make sure we weren't getting too crowded with the fire marshal. And I did 86 certain people, especially those hip-hop guys, because there was fights and guns and shootings, and I had to put an end to that, so I didn't let those guys in there. But in no way did that reflect on Brett. That's not a revenge killing for that, as people have said.
But the word on the street was Brett had been a marked man. One of Cliff's friends messaged Brett's ex-girlfriend, Tony, with details about Brett's murder. He claimed he was at Hollywood Billiards on the night of July 30th when one of the tweakers ran in and announced to the packed pool hall that Brett was dead. He then proceeded to describe in gruesome details how he was killed. Tony reads what the disturbing message said.
There's a girl that floated around Hollywood. She was staying at my apartment for a few days. I went for a walk down Hollywood Boulevard and saw a flyer on a telephone pole. It was a reward poster with Brett's face. That's when the memory of the Mexican Indian death metal guy came flooding into my brain. I immediately went home and texted Cliff to his pager. He immediately called me back. I told him what I knew from Billiards Gossip Mill. I told him about the cuts. He said only the family, police, and the coroner knew that information. I said, yes, plus half of the billiards. Back to the girl. When I went to the apartment to call Cliff, I was freaked out. She told me the following story. She was out in the valley at these gangsters' house. They were Irish. The weird thing is, I had never met anyone in Hollywood with an Irish accent. Anyway, she had crashed on their couch. She woke up and heard them dick wagging, kind of bragging about what happened. She heard the whole thing, jumped up and ran out of the house crying.
Steve Edelson might not believe that Brett's murder was a revenge killing, but many of the other homicide detectives across Los Angeles weren't so quick to rule it out. We talked with other law enforcement agencies, including the LA County Sheriff's Organized Crime Unit and the FBI, to gather more information about criminal activity that may or may not be connected to Brett's cold case. What challenges the original homicide detectives faced was now becoming clear to our cold case team. Trying to solve Brett's murder had been and would be anything but simple, for several reasons. Brett knew a lot of people. The list of potential suspects were long. Many of Brett's friends and associates were withholding information from the police. It was 1993, and forensics had yet to become the essential technology it is today in homicide investigations. However, after almost 30 years later, many of Brett's old friends and associates were finally ready to talk and share what information they knew. That included identifying key people in Brett's life who had never spoken to the police. What they told us next would take our investigation in a new direction that would open up Pandora's box to Hollywood's deepest and darkest secrets. Next episode.
Cliff Cantor becomes the new partner at Dragonfly. Tragedy strikes Hollywood when River Phoenix dies of a drug overdose in front of Johnny Depp's new nightclub, the Viper Room. Victoria Sellers gets arrested, and scandal continues to tighten its grip on young Hollywood.
Thanks again for tuning in. Please help us bring attention to Brett Cantor's cold case by sharing and following the Dragonfly podcast series. If you have information about Brett Cantor's murder on July 30th, 1993, please contact LA Crime Stoppers at 800-222-8477 or visit their website at lacrimestoppers.org to submit an anonymous tip. Also, you can email retired homicide detective Pat Tapia or criminal profiler Paul Dellhauer directly at tips@dragonflypodcast.com. To learn more about the Dragonfly podcast series, check out our website at dragonflypodcast.com. This episode was produced by True Crime Harbor and Cosmic Media. Special thanks to producers JC Nova, Patrick Tapia, Tom Dre, and Georgie Rutherford. Also, audio producer Christopher Lang and sound engineers Parker Ginn, Adam Burt, and Michael Casentini. I'm JC Nova. Thanks for listening.